Hi, this is Barry Ritholtz. Welcome to the very first Big Picture interview, a series we're going to be doing with a variety of well-known and quite brilliant investors from around the world. We kick off this series with legendary Swiss investor Felix Zuloff. You probably know Felix from his years as a member of Barron's Roundtable. He was formerly the head of UBS Asset Management. Now he runs his own shop, Zuloff Asset Management. Later in the interview, I'll get into Felix's views on the market, the economy, where we're going. But first, I got a little personal and asked him, how did he develop his approach to asset management? Where did he go to school? Where did he work? What was his background like? Who were his mentors? And simple things like, where did he grow up?
Oh, I grew up in Switzerland, in a small town. I went through all the schools. After college, I decided to go for a banking career. I regretted it after a year or so because it was so boring, commercial banking. But when I finally hit the investment department, it became more attractive. And I asked my bosses why stock prices moved up and down. And from their answers, I could very soon tell that they had no clue. And so I tried to figure out whether there were some other people who knew why markets were moving. And I found some leading opinion people like Bob Farrell, etc., in the U.S. They were all in the U.S. There were no opinion leaders in Europe. And I decided I wanted to learn that business and foresee market moves in big ways. And then I went step by step. I started then in the stock trading, equity trading department at Swiss Bank in Zurich. Then I was sent to Paris to a stock broker for a year, where I really developed my speculative activity. As a young chap, the owner of the shop gave me a credit at that time about $500,000, which was a dramatic amount for a 23-year-old guy. And I started speculating, went short the market in fall of 1973, and you know what happened thereafter into the end of 74. So that's where I made my first big money.
And your name and reputation, I would imagine.
Your
first, what was your actual first employer? Who did you begin with? Was it
Swiss Bank Corp?
Okay, and how long were you there for?
I was there for 2 years, and then I was sent off to Paris to get acquainted more with the French language and see another country, another culture. And I didn't want to go to a bank because I wanted to learn more at the same time in the investment business, not just the language.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there, came back after a year, moved then to portfolio management. Learned portfolio management, or what they thought was portfolio management, and then was sent to the U.S. after another 2 years. That was in 76 and 77 I spent in New York, put together a trainee program for myself using all the contacts of Swiss Bank Corp. And I trained with Charlie Maxwell in energy and Bob Farrell in market analysis and Ed Hyman in economics and trading with Stanley Shopcorn at Salomon Brothers at that time, etc., etc. So I went through Wall Street, through all these firms, and it was like paradise.
Well, and for people who may not be familiar with Bob Farrell, he was Merrill Lynch's chief market strategist, was the title, for about 30 years. Was there for a long, long time. To this day, David Rosenberg, Merrill's former economist, still references Farrell's 10 Rules of the Market, constantly brings it up. And Farrell actually has a private newsletter that goes out to a handful of people, but not many folks are fortunate enough to have access to it.
That's right. And I'm still friends with many of those people and enjoy the friendly contacts with them.
Right. So Ed Hyman is now running ISI. Charlie Maxwell became a superstar in the energy sector. That was really a murderer's row of all stars in the investment industry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was fantastic. And then the bank called me back to Switzerland in 77, and late 77, and then I changed horses and joined UBS because I wanted to run money and in a more aggressive way, and the Swiss bank didn't offer me an attractive job. So
that was around 1980?
That was late 77. I joined UBS and the mutual fund management department and research. And I ran a U.S. equity fund and then a global equity fund. And I ran a raw material fund and became a global strategist for the whole UBS group at the same time. And later I ran institutional portfolio management department at UBS, and then came 1987 when I ran the institutional portfolio management department, and I was very instrumental in the early 80s to push UBS equity allocation to the highest in all of Europe. At that time, 65% equity in balanced accounts was extremely aggressive for European standards. And in 87, during the summer, I tried to reduce that, and the bank, because I was also part of the investment committee, and I convinced the committee, but general management then vetoed it, and that upset me so much that I started to sell and liquidated all equities ahead of what thereafter became the crash of 87.
Good timing.
And it didn't make many friends, however. And by hindsight, I think it was the most difficult thing I've ever done, because I never got the credits for it. I got the blame, because all my colleagues and friends in the bank looked terrible next to me. It was not, you know, from a political point of view, it was not a good move. From a trustee point of view, it was absolutely the right move. And from a professional point of view, it was also the right move.
That's fascinating that you did the right thing by the clients. And people were upset because, comparatively, they looked bad because they didn't have your prescience in terms of anticipating the market turmoil.
That's right. And then I decided I needed to join a smaller money management operation where I had more freedom, and I joined a subsidiary of Credit Suisse, Clarendon Bank, at that time, as an executive vice president in charge of the whole investment policy. And then came 89, and the leading portfolio managers were very successful there with the Japanese equities, and I turned very bearish on Japan. And they took it as a personal insult that I turned bearish on Japan.
This was 1989, around Nikkei 40-something thousand?
Yes, at 39,000 and something, and it was, I think it was January of 1990, at the Barron's Roundtable. You can still reread it in the old archive edition of Barron's. I turned very bearish on Japan, and Paul Tudor Jones was at the Barron's Roundtable at the same time, and we were the big bears on Japan. And it then happened, and it made it clear to me that I had to go on my own to really manage money the way I thought was right.
So I have to interrupt you here, but before you launched your own firm, you had essentially rotated through some of the biggest banks in Europe. You had come to New York for a couple of years and worked with a number of preeminent investing institutions here in the city. And the takeaway after 10 or 15 years of this was there are institutional impediments for a money manager and a trustee to operate with some freedom on behalf of the clients. Is that the conclusion you drew?
That's right. Yes, that's right.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're not the first person who's actually said this, and it's interesting to hear it from somebody like yourself who's been at the biggest and best shops on both continents.
So I, as a conclusion, I became an entrepreneur and started Zulau Asset Management. I was 40, had a family with two small kids, and it was no client. So the first 6 months was very tough because I could not gain and attract any client in the first 6 months, which was very nerve-wracking. But after that, it started, and the ball got rolling, and I managed individual accounts. I just wanted a limited number of large individual accounts, which I managed in an absolute return fashion. So where I could go long and short, but not leverage, which was basically the way I ran my own money most of the time. I mean, in younger years I have leveraged, but later on I moved away from leverage because too much leverage, I noticed, is where you make most mistakes.
And did you set this up as a hedge fund or more as a managed asset shop?
It was managed assets at the beginning, and after some years, it was just too much work with individual accounts, and I decided to channel everything into a fund, and we launched Zulauf Europe Fund, a fund for European equities, long short, which became very successful, and later we launched a natural resource fund for commodities and natural resource-related equities, and later a global macro fund. Then I was very exhausted in the year 2000 because I basically did everything myself. I had a few employees, two portfolio managers and analysts, but you know, they left at 5 o'clock in the evening, and they went on vacation, and whenever I was on vacation, something went wrong. You know the old story. Basically, you're married with the company, and you're married with the markets, and you cannot let go.
Right. It's different when your name is on the door than if you're
right.
Working for somebody.
That's right. So at 50, and I have to mention that my father died at age 50, and I felt very exhausted at 50. I made enough money, so I decided to go slower, and I wanted to phase out, really.
Uh-huh.
I feared that I would kill myself, and then I started to sell my company in steps, or the majority of it, to these two employees, and for a while it worked out very well. I was more the senior advisor and giving my advice and my input, but I was not running the day-to-day business anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked at the beginning quite well, and over time, which is very natural, they moved into a direction that was too far away, or further and further away from my philosophy, and that created problems because I had raised basically 90% of the assets.
And of course, your name is still on the door.
Yes, and then we decided to split the company, and I moved. I took my share and one fund, one small global macro fund, and kept the name. And they changed their name, and they do their own thing, and I do my thing. And we are totally unrelated these days. So I have just a small shop where I run some conservative global macro money and my own money, and advise some large clients, institutions, and family offices.
So let's talk a little bit.
I have to mention that these times are so fascinating that I don't want to give up running money, but I don't want to be glued to the screen 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I will be the senior advisor to a new launched global macro fund by a company in California, 300 North Capital.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentleman who is a very successful equity long and short manager, he wanted to go global macro. And he asked me to help as a senior advisor, and I will be advising him on a weekly basis and when necessary on a daily basis. But he will do the heavy lifting of the day-to-day operations, while I will give strategic input and be the partner in terms of discussing any of his ideas.
And this is also going to be set up as a hedge fund as well.
This is a hedge fund,
and
yes.
So it'll be global macro, and you're going to be the senior advisor, long short, and not a lot of leverage. That's the approach?
That's right, yes.
So now let me shift gears a little bit with you and talk a little bit about global macro and your methodology, your approach. When you're doing your day-to-day work, what is it that you're looking at? Would you describe yourself as a fundamentalist, as a value analyst, as a technician? What is a day in the life of Felix Zuloff when he gets to the office like when it comes to research and analysis?
Well, I'm a believer in cycles. That means I strongly believe that an economy and all economies do not move in linear but in cyclical fashion, and so do financial markets. And my goal is to catch most of the up cycle and most of the down cycle, because assets are priced according to where the perception is, where we stand in the cycle. So I do a lot of cyclical work. I mean, I do not do moon cycle or anything like that.
Right.
But the classic business cycle, you know, there is this 3 to 5 year inventory cycle, of course, kitchen wave in economic theory. Then there is this more investment-related cycle, which is about 9 years, 8 to 10 years, which is Kuznets. And then you have the 18 to 20 year real estate cycle, et cetera, et cetera. And I try to get a big picture of where the major economies in the world are moving and what the risks and pitfalls and opportunities could be over the next 6 to 12 months. That's basically my work, to find out where we are, at what stage in the business and market cycle. And then, of course, I apply the classic tools like the monetary analysis. I do valuation because capital markets go from one extreme to the other. They never stop in between and reverse back to where they come from. That's important to understand.
Could you explain that in a little more detail?
That means that the stock market, for instance, once it hits an extreme, like in 2000, it does not go to a neutral level in the historic range in terms of valuation and then goes back to overvaluation again. It always goes from overvaluation to undervaluation.
Now, is that true for, let's say, the housing market in the United States?
Well, the housing market has been a linear affair, particularly since the gold standard was abandoned.
Interesting.
But
that allowed, I'm assuming you're referencing that because it allowed for the creation of so much credit, which then led to a 30 or 40 year expansion in housing beyond
right.
what we might have seen otherwise.
That's right. And when you overstay a cycle by these aberrations, like too expansive monetary policy, etc., you could stretch a cycle for longer. But when you do that, you overstay a cycle, you create more and more excesses, and then the correction, when it comes, will be happening in a much shorter time frame than normal, and it will be much sharper and much more painful.
Felix, you may be the first person I've heard who is blaming the U.S. housing bust on Richard Nixon.
Why Richard Nixon?
Because he's the one who took us off the gold standard in the United States.
Well, in a way, you're right. You know, it all started with that, but it added. You know, we didn't let the economic cycle when it went down, and the down cycle is usually here to shake off the weak participants in the system. And to correct the excesses that have been built up during the upcycle. When you do not let it happen, you take more and more excesses with you, which over the long term and over many cycles build up to extremes. And that's where we are now.
Would you say that the ultra-low rates we saw after 2000, after the 2000 crash, when the U.S. Fed took rates down to 1%, so in other words, we never really suffered that cleansing effect of the 2000 crash. We just kicked the can down the road, and now we're dealing with an even bigger problem had we just let that run its natural course?
That's right. It started even, the 2000 excess was really the result of the bailing out and the easy money after the 1998 long-term capital, the Asian crisis,
sure.
The long-term capital and Russian default, etc., etc.
So 97, 98 begat 2000, which begat the 2003 crash, which set up the 07, 08, 09 collapse.
That's right.
That's quite fascinating. And so we end up with these cycles that intervention from the Fed and the Treasury and elsewhere in an attempt to prevent the pain just seems to make worse and worse.
Yes, and now we are at the point where over the last decade, the regulators for the banking industry allowed the banks to reduce their equity capital step by step, which really was another element creating a boom and a bubble in real estate and many other things. And now we are here suffering from the fallouts of that bubble bursting and are here with an undercapitalized banking system in the U.S. and in Europe. In Europe it's even worse than in the U.S. And the problem then comes that the banks had to be bailed out. And bailing out the banks and the system pushed government debt to much higher level. And the question is, what will we do next time when the governments need to be bailed out? You know, because the problem we are facing is we are living in a fiction that we can enjoy a relatively high level of prosperity for our average citizens in the industrialized countries by going more and more into debt. And Greece, in a way, was the stopping point. There is a limit. The market said there is a limit. We are not financing any longer. And then the European Union was transferred changed into a transfer union all of a sudden. Now, the next thing to drop is Spain. Where we have a real estate problem that is bigger than the U.S. There are more homes for sale in Spain than in all of USA.
That's amazing.
You know, and prices have so far only gone down 10% because there are no transactions. But once transactions are forced to by the banks, and the banks are now forced by the government to act and clean out the situation, then prices will come down 30-40%, and probably end at 50% down, and then the banking system is bust, and the insurance system is bust, and then the government has to bail them out, and then the government is bust. And then what? So I see this problem of over-indebtedness moving from the periphery of our global credit system to the center. The center is the U.S., and believe me, the U.S. has its own problems. Half of the U.S. states are running deficits that are bigger than Greece.
So let me step back a second and try and put this into context. We were on the gold standard. We go off the gold standard. That allowed for a massive creation of credit that eventually gets out of hand. When we had our crisis, central banks around the world cranked up the printing presses in order to bail everybody out. So we have a world, on the one hand, awash with cash, and yet there's not sufficient capital in the banks themselves to cover their losses, to cover their bad debts. And now you have governments around the world engaging in the same behavior, bailing people out with money they don't have, and one by one these governments start to need a bailout themselves. Is that a fair summary?
That's right. And I think this whole process will probably run another few years until it reaches the center. And the point is, at some point of time, most likely central banks have to bail out governments. And maybe on the way to that point, there will be some countries and governments that will default and then restructure, which would be the right thing to do, actually. But at the present time, you know, Greece should have been restructured. I mean, they should have declared default. Then the debt should have been restructured. And the problem was that the banks could not take that hit. So bailing out Greece was bailing out the banks.
We've seen that in the United States, all of these mortgage modification programs and all of these various what look like homeowner bailouts are, in fact, ways to funnel money to various banks. In fact, Fannie and Freddie, which so many people love to scream about, they've been just taking all these bad mortgages off the books of the big banks, and it's yet another backdoor bailout for the banks themselves.
That's right. That's right. So I do not know what the final outcome will be. I think historically, when you look at governments that are highly indebted, historically, you have either defaults or you have printing money. I would assume that most of the European countries, not the least because there is the euro and does not allow running the printing press as quickly as when you have one country, one government that has sovereignty over its own currency, that they will probably go to restructuring, while countries that have sovereignty over their own currencies, and I would include the UK and Japan and the US probably, they will probably try to run the printing presses up and go into massive debasement of the currency. This could, of course, create chaos later on in the currency markets and controls, currency controls, etc., etc.
Do you think the EU is at a disadvantage, members of the EU are at a disadvantage, that they don't have the ability to inflict these wounds upon themselves, or does it work out to their benefit that they're forced to take unpleasant tasting medicine now rather than much worse medicine down the road?
Well, I do not believe that a country like Greece can, through conventional steps, heal its situation. That's impossible. I mean, they have a program to cut deficits, etc., etc., but they will kill themselves by doing it. It will push the economy into a massive deflation. and I do not think that is politically possible for a long time. People will revolt.
So what's the solution there?
So in a way, the European situation, the euro situation, the euro acts like the gold standard in the 1930s for the weaker economies. And in the 1930s, those countries came out of depression first that debased and devalued its currency relative to gold, and then they could recover. And I think that will probably be part of the solution. I do not know whether we have never had a situation like that, where basically all the major economies in the industrialized world were hitting the fan at the same time, basically. I mean, this is a unique situation, and I would be lying if I would tell you that I knew exactly what the outcome would be.